Yeah.
Winners.
I'm quite impressed by the turnout tonight. It's pretty good.
They've all got little wings in their ears.
Yes! Oh! I know. I shouldn't necessarily think it's me.
You don't assume they're finally getting it.
Wait a minute, they're crying. Now I know how Dr. Ong's doing.
The version of the Our Father for the Oilers.
Oh, okay.
Do you want to hear it?
Please.
Yeah. Our Father who art in Rexall, hockey be thy name, thy will be done, the cup be won, on ice as well as in the stands, give us this day our hockey sticks, and forgive us our penalties. As we forgive those who cross check against us, it's not into elimination, but deliver us into victory. In the name of the fans, Lord Stanley, and the Holy Oilers. Amen.
The Holy Oilers.
They just scored.
The Oilers.
You can hear all the Oilers.
Yeah. Good.
It worked.
Again.
Power of
prayer.
What a group. Yeah. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. My favorite night. Your questions, my shrugging. Oh, on my answers.
It doesn't have to be about the last two nights that I...
No, never.
I know one question I could ask. Being in college for the past year, I've been thinking about this for a few months. We often have to state our goals, set goals, and everything's very goal-oriented. And I find that I can think in terms of aspirations, maybe, but this thing about never take your eyes off the goal, and I would have trouble stating what my goals are, aside from maybe enlightenment or some very general thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's a danger in them or how to work with that.
Well, and I agree with you that it doesn't suit all people to think that way. There, in fact, in most teachers, when you teach meditation and you're first starting someone to meditate and they have the goal of meditating every day, you ask them, are you somebody who worries in the morning or are you somebody who worries at night? When you come home at night, do you sort of review your day and go over it? Or in the morning, do you get up, does your mind start getting busy before you get out of bed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're someone who, when you wake up in the morning, you already know where you're going, it's probably a good idea for you to meditate in the evening. Because you're not going to be going, you're going to be willing to just have the experience of the present moment because you relax when the day is done. If you're somebody who when you get home, you sit there and you find yourself reviewing the day and going over, then it's probably not a good idea for you to meditate in the evening because you'll keep going into discursive thought. If you're just going to start meditation and you're going to do a short practice, it's better to do it in the morning before your brain kicks in. And you can see that points to the idea that each of us have a slightly different tempo. And sometimes in seasons that tempo changes. Or sometimes at different ages or different events in one's life. Like when you're going through a lot of exams, it might be different than when you're not, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think very much you have to have the skill in knowing when somebody wants you to state something because they've been told that that's a good idea. And do you feel like becoming the person who knocks, who is in the Don Quixote, got your lance out and you're going to tilt with windmills, you're going to clear things that aren't quite right? Or are you going to say, well, that's their idea, somebody else can take care of it, I'll make up some kind of reasonable goal that I could almost believe is mine, mm-hmm. and put it out there. And then, you know, just actually when I'm asked to say how I'm doing toward my goal, just actually name the things that seem to be in line with it, you know? And sort of, yeah, go along with it. But I do have to act according to my own understanding. For me, personally, I go through events, and then I set a goal. After I have had an experience, then I stop, and I look at it, and I say, do I want to do this again? Or what do I want to take from this? But when I'm going into something, I don't think very much about it. You know, that's called a greed type in Buddhism. A hate type is somebody who figures it all out and says, oh yeah, that's what I want. I want exactly that, and it should actually be pink with spaces here and there and no more than a quarter of an inch off the ground at any one point. You know? And then there is this continuous checking to see whether it's lining up properly. What's on my mind? So when somebody asks me to set a goal, I'm really good, like you, on, well, you know, I'd like to be more altruistic, and, you know, I wish I could listen even more deeply, because although I listen fairly deeply to people, I feel like there's a depth I'm not hearing. I wish I had the ability to just be totally empathetic with people. But that's not the kind of goal that somebody is asking for. They say, you know, do you want to work for BP on their new nature program or something like that, you know? So I, for myself, how I have done that when I've been in those few circumstances and have tried to figure out what interests me about whatever it is I'm studying and what they would expect me to go toward, and then I make that into some kind of goal. But really, you know, we are very different temperaments. And like I said, at different seasons, different times. There are times when you know you want to do something. And it just sort of comes up, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But a lot of the time, that's not how you are. You're doing things, and then after you're doing them, you sort of... Right?
Yeah.
So I'm more like that in my temperament. My sister, my surviving sister, is the total opposite of me. She's got her life planned, and she moves it toward her plans. And that's comfortable for her. I would be filled with self-doubt or going back and crossing out the goal and erasing it, and I'd be spending all my time circling around whether or not I did it right or whether it was meaningful, or, you know? Mm-hmm. I would end up running up you know where. At a certain point, it wouldn't get me any value. But probably the popular idea is that it's really important to have aspiration. And I've run into this. There are some schools of Buddhism that say you have to state a goal when you're doing your aspiration. And it has to be a specific goal, something you actually want. Well, it doesn't work for me. Does that mean I can't be a Buddhist? I don't think so. It's one teacher somewhere, it worked for them, so he passed it on to his student, who knows how many years ago. And that student was had charisma and power and energy, and had a whole bunch of students, and they passed it on to all them, and some of them couldn't do that, they faked it because they wanted to please the teacher, and so it became a whole organization. If I want to learn what I can from that organization, I do the best I can at it. What I can't do, I don't worry about it. If someone asks me directly in a private way, how do you feel about goals? I'm probably going to feel them first before I would say this. You know? I'm somebody who reacts better after the fact. Like if there's a crisis, I go through the crisis. If there's a great opportunity, I go through the great opportunity. Then later I'm sitting down having a cup of Assam tea or something and I go, wow, how did that? So I'm a retroactive goaler. Does that give you some sense of a different slant on it?
Yeah, and I can identify with your approach.
Yeah.
They do tend to even want you to be very time specific and have your goal.
Yeah, so
goal.
Make it up, you know, and do a reasonable chart.
Yeah.
And then when you don't quite manifest it when they think you should on your chart, you can pull in a few things and make them just a little more traumatic than they were and say, yes, I think this interfered, or I think, what do you think? Do you think this would have caused me some problems meeting that? You know,
mm-hmm.
Engage them in the conversation so that they feel like they're doing their job.
Yeah.
Because they have a sense that they're supposed to accomplish that, give you a sense of goal and purpose.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that you have in Buddhism is the suffering of becoming.
Well, I was wondering.
So, you know, this is very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, on the one hand, you're supposed to set a goal, which is like becoming of the yin-yang, isn't it? What I am becoming.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, the power of now. So it's an interesting... I'm not sure you could be a conscientious objector in this way that you could do to religious preferences, but, you know, there might be a case for it, but you understand what I'm saying. If
yeah.
that's how it's going and it doesn't cross any ethical boundaries for you.
It can be an interesting question just to ask for that.
Absolutely. My goal today is to remember to eat lunch on time. Not to be on the telephone too long so that I forget to eat lunch until it's 4 o'clock and then I, you know, screwed up. Should I have lunch? That's my goal today. I can make those kinds of goals. I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah.
But, like, what's your goal for this year? What month is that? okay. My daughter might be coming next month. She got the ticket and she said she was coming. So I'm planning to go to the airport on the day she's supposed to fly in to see if she comes. That's one of my real big goals. Oh, and then when she leaves, I'll go to the airport again. But I'm not sure whether we'll go to Drumheller or to the glaciers, or, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm not sure. All of those things are possible. I'd love to go on a dinosaur dig with her and my grandson. I'd love to. You know, a bone dig. It would be fun, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure what they will want to do. And her communication about what she wants to do is even worse than mine. So, that's her father's fault, not mine. Some of these things are genetic. I'm not sure whether she wants to visit her father, her blood father, or not, you know. So I don't know. The goal is to try to be as open and flexible when she's here as I can be. But that's not a time date, and that's not the kind of goal these people are talking about, is it?
I guess I have one issue, one remaining question about this, is whether I kind of just sort of wiggle my way out of things because they're uncomfortable, and I'm wondering if I need to sort of stay the course a little more.
Well, that might be interesting for you. Why don't you pose that as a question and then pick something that you know won't kill you or anything, or wound you terribly for the rest of your existence, that you're not that interested in doing, and pursue it to the end and see what comes up in relation to it. Because for our type of character, that's the best way to get an answer rather than thinking. You know, thinking just takes me in ever diminishing circles. But actually having an experience and then reviewing it. When my body has experienced something, then my mind is clear. When my mind is going on its own theoretical, it just is disgusting where the things I come up with. Why I can or can't do something, or you know, how I write dates in my calendar, you know. ridiculous. So it's nice to take something that is within reason, and you're not sure whether you want to persevere with, and decide you want to try to persevere with it and watch what happens. But I wouldn't try for, you know, Prime Minister of Canada or any of those goals for a test case. I wouldn't try for something where the likelihood of you're not making it is stronger than the likelihood of you finishing it. But then you can watch, so then there's no outer pressure of hope or fear. So you're just watching how you do something like that. And keeping a journal would be interesting too. Sometimes when we do the things that we're putting off, we get more energy. We're putting them off because we feel tired, but when we do them, we realize we're tired because we haven't done them. You know, and the thought of doing them was making us tired. And when we do them, you know, I was telling, I was going to say someone, but now I'm looking at you, Laura. I was telling someone named Laurel only today about a friend of mine who has put off going to the doctor for 3 years because she didn't want to hear. And she went, and she said, oh, it's such a relief to have gone. I'm so glad I went. And she had all this energy, and she was happy. You know, and she spent 3 years hiding in corners because she didn't know what would happen when she went. Like, why not just notice that and do it and then see what happens? You know? And the energy change in her just from doing that was incredible. Because when you're just doing it in your mind, you know, you can come up with every, because you feel a little uncomfortable about saying you're going to do it, or, you know, the mind will go, that's the passion that's happening, so the perceptions that you pull out will be the most negative ones. So your thoughts will always be about what won't be good about it. Whereas if you do it, you open the door for the whole range of experiences to come back to you. Not just the select ones that you're afraid of, which is really, you know, quite decent, actually, overall. I've been saying to a few people lately, you know, there's a big difference between possibility and fixation. You know? When you're fixated on something, you can't see any possibilities. When you're open to possibility, it's amazing what you would never think of that comes up and gives you a blessing. And a lot of people have this problem in some way or other.
Is the difference between goal and aspiration?
In my mind, there isn't. But also in my mind, because I am such a Buddhist, you know, I love that teaching. I love the way it handles these kinds of questions. You set your goal or your aspiration. You say, I really wish to do this. I hope I am able to, whatever deities you want to pray for, or, you know, Lord Buddha or whatever. This is what I would like to see happen. And now, meanwhile, and then you drop it. And you work on what's here. I told you last night about that article in Discover magazine. I'll email it to you so you can put it in.
Okay.
You know. And in it they did this study. Remember me saying this last night?
Yeah.
Where they had two different, what did they call them? Groups, two, one that was gonna do one thing and one was gonna do the other.
Control groups.
That's an amazing word. Two different control groups. And what they did was they gave them a bunch of things that they had to figure out, like buying a new car and deciding what kind of toothbrush they wanted, what color toothbrush they wanted, you know, like that kind of thing. And they gave them these all these different things. And one of the, they were given lots of information on all of those things. And then one of the groups was set to go and discuss it and reread the information and debate it with each other and consider, you know, who knew what. And the other group was told to go and play, do jigsaw puzzles or to play card games or to, you know. do anagrams or anything, but do not think about it. And the control group that didn't think about it made better choices.
Isn't that interesting?
By far. In terms of color of toothbrush, there basically wasn't any difference. On the small choices, there basically wasn't any difference. So you see, there's like scientific studies have been done now that don't necessarily agree with the goal. Like that you should be working toward it all the time. And that is the Buddhist thing. You set your aspiration, you name it with your intent, and you drop it. And you focus on what is present. You do it regularly, you know. Usually, there have been times where one time I really wanted to do a long retreat, and my life just wasn't arranging it. I wanted to do a 6-month retreat, and there were just like too many things. And so every morning, when I was taking my shower, I would say, you know, I would image myself receiving the blessings of Dharma washing over me, and I would say I would really like to do a retreat, you know, in the shower. It was my morning practice at that time. And at night, I would do a little bit of a sit, and then before I went to sleep, I would say, and I really would like to do a long retreat. The rest of the day, I didn't think about it. And I did that for 3 years. I missed a few days here and there, but that was what I wanted. And almost exactly at 3 years, this house was given to me, and I was told to do a 5-month retreat. So sometimes it isn't the ripe time for a goal to come through. And I know lots of people who have worked really hard for their goals and then not had the power to hold them. Because their idea was getting it, but they didn't have the foundation. You know that one, yeah. A lot of us know that one, don't we? I know many people who really wanted something, but when they got it, you know, there wasn't, their intention was to get there, but when they got it, it wasn't fulfilling, and then when they lost it, they spent a lot of time in bitterness, or what did I do wrong, or, you know, and it would take like years for them to get past that and say, okay, how come I couldn't hold it? You know? Maybe I wasn't ready for it yet. Maybe I need to do some other things, you know? Maybe I need to look at what really I didn't have to keep that goal. So it's a much more complicated process than just name your goal and put your timetable and go for it.
I could see the value of articulating what it is you want, because some people, and in the arts you probably see this, people are so driven to perfection that, like, you know, is that what they really want, or have they exactly named what they want?
Yeah, and when you want something, is it an intellectual want? Is it an emotional want? Or is it really the want of your life's pattern? You know, there are so many levels of want itself. When I placed my daughter for adoption, I wanted more than anything to meet her parents and say to them, I really, please love her. I really love her. I don't want to see her. I just want to say to you face to face, please love her with all the love I have for her. Please let her know I didn't place her for adoption because I didn't want her. You know? I really wanted to say that. And it burned me up that I didn't know whether she was adopted, whether she was in an orphanage, whether she was being raised by abusive people. You know? I had no way of knowing. Right? So then I started tormenting myself with not being able to achieve that goal. And what a failure I was. And I was like a bad person. I didn't deserve to have her. And how dare I just abandon her like that, you know? Drove myself a bit crazy, a bit. You know? Drove myself right down. What a waste of time. And then I started praying for things. Okay, I can't do this. I can't go to your parents. I can't meet you. Okay, see a beautiful tree. Wherever you are, whoever you are, wherever you're living, may you see all the beautiful trees. I give you beautiful trees. Right? And then when I read a poem, I read it now. Wherever you are, whoever you are, listen to this. This is a poem by Theodore Rothke. It's so beautiful. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. I feel my fate in what I cannot fear. I learn by going where I have to go. We think by feeling. What is there to know? No? Feeling. What is there to know? I feel my being dance from ear to ear. I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. Light takes the tree, but who can tell us how? So I meet her several years later. I've sent her that poem like 20 years before this. And we're walking on the streets in Ottawa. And it's kind of a cloudy day, and then the sun comes out of the clouds and hits the trees. And I'm not even thinking, I just say, light takes the tree, but who can tell us how? And she says, I wake to sleep and take my waking slow. I don't know 10 people who have read that poem. Of all the people I know who read poetry. Isn't that interesting? And she, you know, she says, look at that tree. Or she says, did you hear that bird? You know, I send her birds from New Zealand, birds from Thailand. So, you know, sometimes goals are not going to be met in a timeline. Because there's other things that need to be done before we have the power to hold that. If I had met her when I was most desperate. Yeah, can you imagine meeting a crazy Cecily, stoned out? Like, I just want you to tell me, really, I love my daughter and I really don't. What cold cops, you know? Like, what good would that have done? You know? I would have had no power to hold that. Because I had no power to stand in myself and accept what I was. And then start working with that. Does that make sense? I think the first goal is to stand in yourself and start working with that. And every other goal comes from that. Because when you start working with yourself, the things that are really your importance, your gifts, and your values emerge. And 3/4 of the time, we don't even know what they are. Although I have to admit that as a child, when I was 8 and 9, I always wanted to grow up and be a teacher. But I was thinking kindergarten, you know, grades 1 to 4 or something like that. And they didn't have gurus at career day in high school.
It was, that would be interesting.
Yeah. Which is because not many role models. That's probably why I have my own style of doing that. Yeah. That's my excuse.
Have a guru at a
career.
Yeah,
they didn't have them. Does that help give you a better sense? I mean, it's better to pray the positive than to fear the negative. It's a better use of your human energy, and it's more likely to ripen you toward your goals, whether you know what they are or not. Because the wholesome always causes you to grow toward greater joy, greater strength. The unwholesome always feeds self-doubt and causes you to become self-grasping, self-clinging, usually in a negative way. It's true, isn't it? Like, oh, I'm going to go shopping today. That's the kind of goal you can make with your mind. Now, what am I going to get? But, you know, I'm not so sure. No. Certainly, if you decide you're going to take a university course, you do have the goal of finishing it. Mm-hmm. But whether or not you actually do, you're going to find out as you work on it.
They're kind of spontaneous, I find. I just realize that I want something.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. You're more like me in that.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, my sister, you know, she knew what she was going to be when she grew up, and she became it. And then she changed her mind after she'd done it for a little while, and she knew what she was going to do then, and she was that. It was like 1, 2. Hmm. And me, I don't know. I just wish I could be a secretary so I didn't have to think these things. I don't know what I want to do. Can I just be a secretary, please? Oh, please. Oh, must be a god. If there's a god, make me a secretary, please! Save me from this being me. Oh, what a good idea. And would I have ever met such good friends? I don't know. I doubt it. I'd be on antidepressants of yin yang, drinking all weekend, screaming at the neighbor's cats. You know. That's what I think I would do. Worried about whether the car wash put a scratch on my car. I mean, that's what, you know, I'm glad I'm not doing that. Maybe some of you are too. So there is that quality. For some people, it's like your life is malleable. You don't have a goal. I think I was born with a lot of possibilities, but no strong intent. And due to the circumstances that happened to me and the causes of my life, intent formed through my life. And I think you're more like that. I think if you set goals that you, in the past, you would get too idealistic about them.
Or I'd feel trapped by them.
Yeah. Because you feel idealistic, then you get trapped because you feel like they're too hard or it's not really right or you can't do it. It's the idealism that causes the rebellion, is what I'm saying. So, you know, I think there are some people that it's really not a good idea for them to set goals. Not that they shouldn't set any goals, but they should set goals with a kind of a looseness. It would be nice if I could. And if, you know, there are no ripples in the entire of creation, then maybe if I could finish it in like 3 years, that would be good too. But we'll see. You know, that's a reasonable goal for some people. Maybe again, I won't. Who knows? But that's not what you're being asked to do by the course you're taking.
No.
So you have to take it.
And I've heard there's two types of approaching. One's the literal way, one's the conceptual. One is really very specific, and the other one's more general.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want a good education, so that will unfold as it should. And the literal one will be, well, how am I going to, you know, do you get very specific in terms of the course I'm going to take? But the bottom of it, I want education.
Yeah, and for some people that works really well.
Yeah. Or you set the conceptual, then the literal, the steps will present themselves.
But it's not uncommon that you set the conceptual and then it changes its course halfway.
Sure.
So that's
sure.
what I'm suggesting, because if somebody thinks that they're not measuring up, if it changes, they could get caught by that.
Oh,
so
okay.
I'm talking about people who tend to be idealists.
Okay.
Like for a long time, I felt like a failure because I never went to university. And then sometimes I'd be doing poetry readings or giving classes, and people would say, "Where'd you get your degree?" I think, what degree? Third degree? And they actually thought, because my mind has got a lot of interest, and I've got a very broad kind of reading pattern, that I had some kind of degree or something. So then I started dropping in on university courses and listening to what was taught, rather than just thinking about, gee, I wish I went. What are they doing? So I go sit in on classes. I found out a lot of what they were reading were things I was reading. So it's interesting, you know, how that there are different types of people. And in some way, all of us are slightly different here and there. We all have our quirks. And our so trying to measure up or fit in or be what you're not is a disservice. But excusing yourself for not being what you're not is also a disservice. To be interested in what you are and then try to see how that can be nurtured and grown, that's service. That's the most important service. Not to say, oh well, this is just who I am and that's it. That's disservice to the gift of your life. Or to say, well, I should do this. That's not necessarily right either. But to say, well, what is really, who am I? And what kind of energies and what talents do I have? Like singing or whatever. What should I be opening to, you know? The real measure of a successful life has more to do with joy than it has to do with being able to set goals. Don't you think? Joy is important?
Absolutely.
Goody. Have I beaten that one to death? Nice question, thank you. Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints? You know, if you don't come up with it, you still can't go.
Maybe they're waiting to get back to the game.
I know, that's why I just said that. I'm watching people saying, let's see, is it the first period's over now? Let's see. Excuse me. We're doing a class here, right?
I was still thinking about, we did the teaching on Thursday, and you came up, or there was in this thing called the sign. And what we were talking about tonight, sort of setting goals up where you can actually see something and then, like, change it.
Yeah.
And that's the sign.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, where you, it's how you change it is the sign.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like, if you see angry thoughts arising, you change it to a good thought,
right,
or something that made you happy.
Or that would make it better. Or
yeah, a good thought, a wholesome,
something
beautiful. Because you don't want to be distracted by anger when you're meditating. So you're meditating on the breath, say, and then some little memory comes and then an angry thought comes up. And as soon as you notice the angry thought, well, you do the other exercise first, but then when it comes to the sign, you bring a sense of beauty in or something. Because I know I'd rather think of beauty. You bring beauty up, and then you drop it, and you go back to the meditation. So, like it said, wouldn't it say there were five signs?
Yes, I think
there was. Yeah. So it's like taking something that you focus on is the sign, you know. I'm not sure that's the right word, but do you have the text here? And we'll just look at it.
Josh copies from the back room.
But is the footnotes in the Xerox copies?
I think this is just around the country.
Yeah, because it's confusing terminology, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I didn't know how to really get it really clearly, but it sounded really significant, because I think, well, to me, I can kind of relate it because of certain things that I thought was important as a practice, and I would do it, and
yeah, it is
basically
important.
Just to have a better emotional experience.
Those sutras are talking about how not to get caught by the unwholesome.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's what they're talking about, isn't it? 19, 20. They're all talking about how not to get caught by the unwholesome. Because the wholesome mind is open and interested and more likely to see things as they are. The unwholesome mind takes you in old patterns based on the past and projects them into the future. When something didn't work for you once, and then you remember something that's happening today and it reminds you of the same kind of thing, your mind, if you think about it, will take you to the fact that it didn't work once before. So it pulls you to the past, and then you get stuck in projecting that on the future. So instead, you just substitute that with a wholesome. So, when you want to develop a strong sense of concentration, when you want to really bring your concentration in strong so you can put your mind somewhere and it stays there, right? Which is called jhana. But that state of concentration, and this is what the footnote actually says, the higher mind is the mind of the 8 meditative attainments used as a basis for insight. So when you want to get the mind really concentrated, because the mind has to be just looking at what is for insight to arise. If it's going to the past or the future, insight won't arise. It'll be memory mixed with hope and fear projected on possibility. Whereas if your mind is clear and present and concentrated, then when you ask a question, you're more likely to get a new direct insight, seeing into the present moment. Right? If the mirror is dirty, you're not going to get a good reflection. If it's got the dust from the past, you know, you're not going to get a good reflection. If it's clear and easy to see, concentrated, nothing is in the way of it, then you're going to get a good reflection. So, use is a base. It is called higher mind because it is higher than the ordinary mind of daily life. Because in ordinary time, we're not concentrated. You're listening to me for a few moments, and then you hear the bird outside, and then you're listening to me, and then you're wondering if that was what I was talking about or was it something else, and you're listening to me, and then you're feeling dinner in your belly, and then you're listening to me, right? Mm-hmm. The mind is going like that all the time in the ordinary mind. When you're training yourself to meditate, you slowly train yourself to keep the mind thought, the thought beats of the mind streaming in one direction only. And modern writers of Buddhism compare that to the difference between a flashlight and a laser light. In a laser light, you just have all the particles beaming in one direction, right? And it's very bright, sharp light. But a flashlight might have a little blur on the lens, and the bulb might be a little marked on one side. It might be diffusing out this way, so it's lighting here and here and here. But a laser light is one pointed. So your mind beats. Do you remember this?
Yes.
How often?
317
times faster than matter. matter beats at the speed of light. This is one of the descriptions I have read. Another one is the mind beats trillions of times in a second. Every beat of mind is just a focal point, like a pointless painting. And every beat of mind, if it is just in the ordinary mind, rather than the higher mind, it's going all over. Oh, the car went by. Oh, I didn't hear him honk his horn. I guess there wasn't a score. Oh, you know? Oh, I wonder what the game was about. Oh, did I turn the burner off? Oh, did I, you know? You know how it goes. So the ordinary mind is like that. When you train your mind, every beat of mind is on the same focus point. What happens is that cuts down the sense of subject-object duality. Because you can only compare yourself to other in relation to, okay? In relation to me, you are male. In relation to me, in relation to you, I am female. In relation to us, we are human. You know? I don't know if you got that. Did you get that? In relation, you can say there's a difference. When there's subject and object, you can say, you can make a differentiation. And this is definitely set apart. When there is no subject-object duality, there is just absorption into the present moment. There is nothing to relate it in reference to. You all got that? Right? So it is a very blissful experience, because where we get caught and anxious is when we start comparing. So when you train your mind to just be one-pointed toward one object, just in a nice, relaxed, clear way, it is a very blissful experience. It's very calm, it's very clear, because your mind is mostly beating on one point and not so much checking everything else around and wondering if you got it or did you just fart or did somebody, you know? Good, you got that. So I've beaten that one to death and we all got it. Okay, good. Next. It is called higher mind because it is higher than the ordinary mind. Ordinary wholesome mind, even. Because the ordinary wholesome mind is still shopping all the time. The five signs may be understood as practical methods of removing the distractive thoughts. And I don't see them actually saying what the five signs are here. And they say the five signs are nimitta, but nimitta is a very big word. A lot of things are collected under the word nimitta. And so, like, basically what I have been taught and what I was taught isn't actually classical Buddhism, but the way I was taught it was, if hatred comes up, look at the clarity of the mind that is reflecting the hatred. So I've talked to you about when you're caught in a movie, look at the screen. You know? Like that kind of thing. Or when you see a hate state coming up, bring in a flower or some nimitta, some sign of something that is not that state. Break it and then go back to the one-pointedness. Because otherwise, those mind states will just lead you away from the one-pointedness. So that's one of the ways. And then it says, this is Sutra 20, by the way, in case you were wondering. When thoughts of sensual desire arise, and so you try that, when unwholesome mind states arise, you bring in a wholesome state as a sign just for a moment to balance the mind, and then you bring it back to focus. When desire, clinging states arise, like idealizing a lover or something like that, you do what I said, you know, you imagine if it's a male, you could imagine that they just left somebody with AIDS and their cock is dripping with having, you know, sex with them, and now they're looking for you, or that the big booger is hanging out of their nose, or, you know, whatever, something that causes a shock to the sensuality that pulls you back. And in that brief moment of being pulled back, you bring your focus back. I'm using extreme analogies so you get the idea. So when a negative clinging arises, you bring in beauty to soften the mind. When a I want it, a greedy, willing to go for it, distraction arises, you bring in the ugly. Is that good?
Well, maybe.
You don't like the second one?
No, I was just wondering, isn't there a better way to work? Well, I'm not saying
that's
better.
Very quick.
Not say better, but there is different ways to work with that.
Oh, yeah. These are just two of the ways that are suggested, especially in the beginning.
Yeah.
Because when you're sitting there, what will happen is the conditioned, habitual ways of thinking will come up and break your concentration. So what you're doing is every time one of those comes up, you introduce its opposite, which breaks it and brings you back more quickly. So you're just pushing the cancel button, basically, when you're doing that. And when I'm describing it, I'm making it much more complicated. But once you get the idea, it's just very fast. It takes like a brief second, and then you're right back on track. And you do that like two or three times, pretty soon those thoughts stop. They just stop. They don't start coming up anymore. And so your focus is better. That's why the Buddha suggested it, because it works. When you're thinking, well, do I have to do that every time? You don't understand. If you interrupt a habit a few times, about the fourth or fifth time it starts to emerge, you've already got the habit of interrupting it, so it isn't so strong. You don't get carried by it. It sort of just starts to go and then disappears before it really gets full strength. So it makes it easier for you to focus your mind where you want to. You know, we learned all of our hopes and fears and our discursive thoughts through the process of life. So, you know, most of the time we weren't conscious when we learned them. So now to be conscious in how, whether or not we want to continue them is basically what it's saying. You're just checking the program and see if you want to delete some of the settings, you know? Cleaning out the files. Been there, done that, don't want to go back. Throw it out. But that's what it is saying, when you want to develop the concentration.
Okay.
And maybe you want to just try it for 5 minutes a day, just out of interest, rather than thinking, oh, I have to do it. You don't have to do it. But if you would like to see what it feels like to have that one point of concentration, take like 5 minutes and just see if you can just keep your mind on one object, like, you know, maybe the second hand of your watch, or maybe your breath, you know. Maybe a flower, doesn't matter. And just see if you can just softly rest your mind there and keep it from wavering. And when it wavers, don't argue, don't get agitated, just sort of bring it back. And you'll find that something starts, this kind of an energy that starts around your body. You'll start to feel this kind of light energy vibrating around you. And then usually some habitual discursive thought will come. And if it's one of hatred, you introduce beauty. If it's one of sensuality, you introduce the repulsive, and it just stops. It's like, for hatred, the blotting paper is beauty. For sensuality, the blotting paper is ugly. So it's just, oh, spilled some ugly there. Okay, here's the beauty. And meanwhile, you just keep your focus. Yeah.
Is there a delusion one in that set?
Doesn't really matter with delusion. It'll just make a story out of it anyway.
But how does but how do you break delusion?
The most important way is like just by continuing to try to watch the breath. Because, you know, the thing about delusion, at some point you will want to make a theory about the breath so you'll actually start paying attention. Now, delusion is basically this mind that can hold great overviews.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful, like university professors and things like that. Beings who are universal rulers, they do delusion really well. And they do. But whether they can easily let go of a delusion and let it dissolve and see another possibility, that's where their suffering is. Because they get very attached to their delusions and they try to get everybody to help them hold it up because they just thought of another room they'd like to add. You know? So really what you want to do is give them a single focus point and, you know, and eventually they'll have to gather more data about that in order to make it into an even better delusion. And that's how you do it. In the Visuddhi Magga and the Vimuti Magga and most of the meditation texts, they say for a hate type, it's best for them to work with beauty. For a greed type, it's best for them to work with the unpleasant. And for a delusion type, it really doesn't matter, but you might as well give them the breath because it's probably the most likely to be useful to them. And where there is greed or hatred, there's delusion too. Because you're clinging to a view. Right? And so, we're always working with delusion. But there are people who aren't particularly angry or particularly sensuous, but they're really big on ideas. Right? And we all have all three of them. And we also have all three of them in their wholesome. You remember what they are? When greed is free of, the greed type is free of self-clinging, it becomes faith. When the hate type is free of self-clinging or self-grasping, it becomes what? Intelligence. Because hatred can just see the point, can't it? I just see just exactly what's wrong with the way your hair is combed tonight. I mean, you did it really well on that side, but that side is not even. If you just had just, you know, you're really well, but your hair is like driving me nuts. Couldn't you just fix it? Let me fix it for you. You know how that happens. When there is anger, you get fixated by a point. And you almost wait for it to come around, you could say, there, I knew it would come again. Don't you? Mm-hmm. Is that true? Or other people, when they're getting angry, isn't that true? There's this sense of... So the ability to see the point. Intelligence. And delusion? People with Manjushri as their yidam often fall into delusion. I know. You know who my yidam is.
All of my jujuries.
Yeah. Because there's something about a theory that's entirely satisfying. It's not risky or anything, you know. A manjushri may be sharp, but they certainly don't want war. So theories are a nice, you know, buffer, right? But we all have all three, or all six, and we're all working with them, so it's nice to be able to identify all of them.
What's the antidote to delusion?
Huh? What is delusion when it's... The antidote to all of them is not be caught in self-clinging, to have equal density inside and outside your body. And when delusion is free of self-clinging, it's intuitive overview. Like the ability to see a pattern and then let it go and then see another pattern and the continuous coming into being and passing away of multiverses. Which is when, you know, a division type is most happy. Playing with multiverses, is that? Like when you actually find a new theory, isn't it exciting? Or when somebody else sparks one, don't you just feel like something? Or you get a new idea, or suddenly something that you felt sort of wasn't quite right, and suddenly a new light shines up. Then that sword is flashing, and then books are humming. Oh, yeah, got it. Ooh, yeah, ooh, ooh. And then pretty soon you start making it solid. But when it's solid, it's not as much fun, because you can hear how pedantic you are. Isn't that true? And your heart kind of hurts when you're being pedantic like that, doesn't it? Because you'd rather have the flow. So then you kind of try to cover your tracks, so that makes you more pedantic. I get classes all the time, I know all about this. I listen to myself sometimes. Sometimes I listen to tapes like, oh, fuck, shut her up. Get her off that chair. When some people say, I listen to your tapes and I really don't like the way you teach, I go, oh, yeah. But that was an aside. So is that reasonable? You know what all three are, and they're when they're not subject to self-clinging, what are they? Greed is what?
Faith.
Why is it faith? What is the quality about greed and faith that's shared? What does greed do? Always reaching for more. What does faith allow you to do? To reach for more. But the difference is the self-clinging. With greed, it's I want more. With faith, is there's probably more. Isn't it? Same quality, but without the self-absorption. What does hate do? Yeah. Focus. Very clear differentiation. Right? Doesn't it?
Yeah.
And what about intelligence? Differentiates. Well, this is slightly more, you know, this one is more of that one than, you know, I think actually if we're going to do that, we should put it this way. And what's the difference?
One's a flow and the other one's fixed.
One is grasping to self. I don't like that.
It's solid.
They're both solid in a way. They're both solidly saying, oh look, this point here could go that way, and you know, they're still both working with points but in a totally different way. And delusion? I talked about ignorance last night and how it's like a cover, isn't it? To cut things out so that you can manifest, you need ignorance to cut out totality. If you couldn't practice ignorance, you wouldn't be able to pick up this book because you wouldn't be able to differentiate the book between the floor, between the pillow. Right? No, difference. Differentiate. So with ignorance, it's the ability to pick out a pattern. Oh, this is the book. This isn't the book. Right? I can ignore this because this is the book. And hold to a pattern. But when you hold to that pattern with self-clinging, I am this pattern, this is my view, I am my view, it creates this being stifled or caught, doesn't it? And this feeling of loneliness, doesn't it? Like that poem I read.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're able to see a pattern and then let it go, like you can when you're a kid and there's a chair and you got your blanket with you and you're 2 years old and you go and you see the chair and you turn it on its side and you put your blanket over and now it's a tent. Now it's a cave. And you go underneath with the blanket over the top of the chair. You know? Maybe it's a chair, maybe it's a cave. Maybe it's a horse. Because it could be all of those things, can't it? Didn't you ever do things like that when you were a kid? You got it. Oh, good. Okay. You're all sort of like looking at me. Oh, I know. Is the audience are doing something? Psychic pickup on me? Yeah. So you can see that there's an overview, but it's changeable. Then you get up and, you know, your mom puts the chair up and you sit on it and it's no longer, it's a chair now. So you can have dinner. So it's flowing and moving. There isn't a sense of having to hold it. Does that make sense?
Theory, it stops the flow of the energy.
Yeah, it's self-clinging because the theory actually has you. You're inside of it. And it's your banner. Yeah, people whose work is this lifetime mostly delusion due to that. And it's usually people who have a very big mind, very big overview. And like there's this sense of confusion almost if you let it go. Not knowing doesn't have the security. But nothing has security. I mean, truth is, a hate type is afraid that something is going to cause them pain. So they find out every point that could be negative. A greed type thinks that they're not going to get enough. So they start eating everything in sight, and that makes faith. They don't until they're poisoned, and then they you know come out of Bardo and they think, oh, this is a nice place to come. I wonder what there is to eat here. Do you understand what I'm saying? Greed, hatred, delusion. The three in the center of the wheel. You see those three animals. They represent greed, hatred, and delusion. And we have all three, and they're cycling around, but one of them, coupled with delusion, will be our fave. Some of us, that's not true, some of us do flip between passion, desire for something, but then sure that it's not going to work, so like hating it before it happens. Not looking at anyone who mentioned it. So there's this desire, but at the same time, sharpness, you know, and that can happen, that the two of them, and in the Visuddhi Magga, if you read that book, and the Vimuti Magga, they talk about that, how if somebody is passion with hatred, how this is the best meditations for them to do, if somebody is dullness with hatred, you know, like this. I mean, in Buddhism, it gets very specific about those things, you know, and some of it, especially in the Visuddhi Magga and the Vimuti Magga, they do go into some detail about trying different meditations. And once you learn the basics of meditations, and you get past the barrier of the different language that is used there, and you can start to understand what's being said, it's really nice to take those 38 or 40 meditations and play around with their advice and see, well, what happens if I do this one? You know, not to do it right, but just to explore it. And just explore it on your own. I mean, if you're interested in meditation or interested in your own mind, why not explore it? Why not take like 10 minutes every day and just play with this meditation for a week and then put it down and then see what happened with that and then take 10 minutes and do another one? You know, 10 minutes. And decide whether you're going to do it in the morning, in the evening, and which one works best for you. You know, why not do that? I highly recommend it. You may have noticed.
What about these 38 meditations?
The 38 are in the Vimuti Magga, which is V-I-M-U-T-T. I don't know if it's H-I or just I right now. I can't remember. Magga, M-A-G-G-A. It's not as thick as the Visuddhi Magga, which is 40 classical meditations. And the Moody Manga is very difficult to get. I have a copy, you know. I could bring it up next time I come if you want, or you could have a look at it. And the Visuddhi Magga, V-I-S-U-D-D-H-I, Visuddhi. One is Vimuti. One is the path of freedom, the other is path of purification. Yeah. Path of purification is Visuddhi Magga. V-I-S-U-D-D-H-I-M-A-G-G-A. So Magga is path. It has 40 meditations in it. And they are basically summaries of different meditations the Buddha gave to people during his lifetime. So they're compilations after his life. And they were done around the same time, and they depended on each other to a certain degree, and on some of them there was a lot of discussion about what was the real teaching and what wasn't, and lots of little, you know, sect wars going on in a very Buddhist polite way in the early days of Buddhism. And those two books have survived, and then aspects of them you see in a lot of the schools of Buddhism today. So they have a lot of the same meditations, but they might have slightly different descriptions about how to do them. For example, they both cover the elements, but the Visuddhi Magga and the Vimuti Magga have quite a different way of describing what color of earth, for example, you can use, or you know how to do that. So they're both very interesting to look at. I have two copies of the Visuddhi Magga and one of the Vimuti Magga. The Vimuti Magga has been out of print for a long time and very difficult to get. Do you want me to bring them up next time I come?
Yes, please.
Okay, I'll do that.
I've got a copy of the Path of Purification.
Yeah, Visuddhi Magga. And Trungpa's group put out a reissue of that. So it has been reissued, and it's usually printed every once in a while again in Sri Lanka or Burma or something. So I have both. I have both Trungpa's edition and an old one from Sri Lanka, which is a one volume, and they're both heavily thumbed. Unfortunately, I must admit that one of them even has writing in the margins. So is that enough, or do you want more questions, or want to go hit the Oilers, or what? Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints? I really like your questions, you know, it's really important to me to be able to, you know, be more specific to things you're interested in. And I think it causes me to look more deeply at what I've studied. That's the thing that is wonderful about friends in Dharma, is that it keeps you looking and fresh and always studying again. That's like invaluable. That's why Sangha is one of the refuges. And it is, isn't it? If you actually are open with Sangha, you find you become more honest and more willing to share. Because what problems or joys have you had that everybody in this room hasn't had? Really? You know? Okay, maybe you weren't quite so extreme as me, but you know what it's like when a kid goes missing.
I've had to work in a town office last year, and I realized the more often I go downtown on the bus as opposed to driving my car, I notice more and more street people. I was really, really shocked early on when I realized that I had an extreme, violent hatred of Indians.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd go along, you know, wondering where I came from, and go to all kinds of lengths to avoid walking by Indians. They didn't have money, they didn't have money there. And then I'd look at, was it just Indians? Was it
And it was very clearly just very turmoil environment, physical. And so today, you'd suggest that I do pressure swimming good for a while. So last night I did it twice. I go downtown to go to work swimming. And there's an Indian guy sitting on the sun box office outside the second cup, and I'm on my way to get my latte before I go to work. And I really don't like this one, because I've seen him a few times, and not only is he an Indian, but he's really, really ugly. He's got this violent feel. And so I'm finding out how I'm going to go back at it here so I don't have to go by him. And I'm halfway across the street, and I go, well, what would happen if I walked by him? And it was just, it was like right in the middle of the street, so I know. So I walked by him, and then I just am coming up to him, and I say, well, what if he was just a guy needing some money for a coffee or whatever? And he's like, oh, I'll put my hand in my pocket and give him whatever coin comes out. And there's, you know that when you're sitting in meditation, there's something sometimes that happens with the eyes when the focal length comes here rather than further out where it's very focused. That just seemed to happen with my eyes. And in a kind of way, he became very clearer to me in a very more diffused way. It was a very curious thing. And I put this loonie in his hat, and he said, thank you, in this most beautiful voice that I can't ever remember hearing. And it was such a shock to the whole image of what I had been carrying for a long time. You know, when you were talking a while ago about the woman who was afraid to go to the doctor for 3 years, mm-hmm. It was like that.
I think this is it.
And, you know, and I don't know what that was. Except that it was some kind of thing broke.
Yeah, you broke through fear by having the right to see for yourself.
Yeah.
You didn't let a story stop you from being alive. That doesn't mean that the fear is gone or it won't come up again. It just means that you know you don't have to believe it.
Yeah. But it was so odd because it didn't come from planning it out with the goal of,
no.
Well, I don't want to be a prejudiced person, so
no,
I should.
No, but it did come
this.
From precious little girl.
It did.
Yeah.
Absolutely. A direct link.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you think meditations work?
Yeah.
Oh, son of a bitch. Maybe I should do some.
And even when I'm not meditating or feeling like I'm not meditating, they're still working.
There you go.
And that's what I really like about it. Getting into it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You don't know how painful it is in prison until you let yourself out. Until you finally say, okay, there is no wall, there is no door, there is no key. I'm out of here. You can always go back if you want. You know, I mean, you know, if you feel you haven't quite perfected your cell yet, you can go back in there and play it for a few more lifetimes or whatever. But really, I keep thinking to myself, do I want to die with my heart practicing fear, or do I want to die with my heart practicing openness? And that's the bottom line, isn't it? Because the one thing I can't do anything about is that I'm going to die. I can do everything about how I die here. But I can't do anything about the fact that this is a temporary abiding. And spending my time polishing it doesn't work. Is that true? So there's a lot of things that happen in life that one doesn't like. In fact, one they terrify one, or whatever. But how are you going to work with that terror? Are
Are you going to do greed, hatred, or and delusion, or are you going to look for, okay, are there other choices? How do I like my heart to feel? I prefer to practice love. Oh God, this is going to be hard. Okay, well, maybe I'll walk by him, step by step. And if you open yourself to the idea, it will present itself in a way that you can do it. There is no substitute for kindness. To yourself, kindness to others, there is no substitute. Being good is not as good as being kind. So I'm sorry I don't have any bad jokes to tell you, but I'll let you go even though it's only 10 to 9. Terry's already out the door. Did you hear a horn right now?
Yeah.
That was because I heard you guys be going up to your TVs. Feel this beautiful light in your heart. This is the Stanley Cup glowing with Edmonton.
I'll go with that.
Dr. Ong and Lucy in their masterpiece. Dr. Ong and Lucy in their ongoing friendship and joy together. It's us together being willing to be friends. It spreads out from our hearts, fills this room, fills the house. Edmonton gets washed. Oh, let's get the game. Just spread it with loving kindness. Just oh, yeah. Whole of the world, just everywhere, anywhere there is suffering. Body, speech, and mind is just washed. Anyone you want to pray for. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our kind, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our kind, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering. So thank you for your great compassion.